Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk here on Transitions Tuesday. Now, we know that 2015 saw more than its fair share of traumatic events, and it seems like what might have been characterized as mean or not nice is now all but deadly and often actually is deadly. Joining me today is an internationally known and respected psychiatrist and thought leader, Dr. Mark Goldston, to help us begin the process of teasing through the many ways in which we can, but often don't, make a difference in our lives and the lives of others. Dr. Mark Goldston, welcome to Mind Talk.
I'm so pleased to be on, so pleased to be talking about this topic, and kind of sad that we need to talk about this topic because it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Sad indeed. Now, folks, when I say an internationally known and respected individual, this is by no means an exaggeration. Dr. Goldston, I'm going to list some of your clients. You have worked with IBM, Goldman Sachs, the FBI, British Airways, Los Angeles District Attorney's Office, and more. You've been interviewed in Fortune Magazine, Los Angeles Times, CNN, MSNBC. I mean, the list goes on. You're the author of many books. I mean, the list really does go on. But there is one thing that I would like to get out of the way before we really start our conversation about really healing the world one conversation at a time. As I listed some of your clients, it's pretty clear, I'm sure, to the listeners that many of them have represented perhaps the worst of the worst with respect to racism, sexism, financial greed, and simply just having a non-caring, elitist take on the world. And yet, here you are today talking with us about healing and peace and caring. Is there a disconnect or no?
Well, here's the first takeaway for listeners that occurred to me in the last few years. I look much younger than I am. I'm kind of a youthful guy in his 60s. And what I've realized is that there's three stages to life. And the first stage of life is doing what you should do. And what that means is you need to develop credibility in the world around you. You can't just be a rebel without a cause. And so you need to do what you say you're going to do. You need to cooperate. And until you build a track record of things that really allow you really to stand up to people and differ with them and get into a dicey conversation, you really need to do what you should do. Otherwise, you're too much problem. And then after that, in the middle stage of your life, and I'm not getting this exactly accurate, but I think doing what you should do probably starts to go up until about age 40. Maybe late 30s. And then from age 40 to maybe 60, 62 is doing what you could do. And what you could do is thinking, geez, what are all my skills? What's all my potential? What's the best way to realize those skills in the best way? And then, and that's when you pull things together. And the final stage, which is what I'm in, is doing what you're meant to do. Doing what you were born to do. And it's interesting, in other interviews, this is slightly out of context, but in other interviews, there's an exercise that I've shared that people found very helpful, and it's a quickie, so I'll share it with you.
Great.
If you think of your personality as a circle, and in that circle, you think of the parts of your personality that are trying to prove something to someone else, show something to someone else, hide something from someone else, or please someone else. Prove, show, hide, please. And if you eliminate all of those, what is left? And a number of people, when they pause, they say, nothing's left. And I say, well, if 100% of you is focused on proving, showing, hiding, and pleasing, then you don't belong to you. And so what happened to me is as I crossed over from what I could do to what I meant to do, is I pushed all that stuff out of my personality, and I realized that there was a calling that had been calling out to me probably for at least 30 years. And the calling, and I get emotional about it, is the world is hurting, afraid, and angry, and you might be able to do something about it, Mark. And it was so clear and so loud, definite, that's part of what fueled Healing the World One Conversation at a Time, and the mission of Healing the World One Conversation at a Time. And imagine this. It's a simple mission. Teach people how to talk with each other, which is different than talking at people, over them, or even to them, and have everybody in the world have one conversation per day, or more, but one conversation per day where they are talking with another human being. If we could do that, it would change the world in a day.
Absolutely. And it's a powerful concept just to think about. Because you're right. I mean, we spend so much time talking, but not really saying a whole lot that's useful, and often not listening at all. So let's kind of start at the beginning of a person. Are people born to be judgmental or hostile or combative, or is this something that happens over time? You know, how do we not engage in healing practices and then move to engaging in healing practices is the question.
Well, something I'm going to send you from my most recent book is called Talking to Crazy, How to Deal with Irrational and Impossible People in Your Life. And I'll tell you my MO on this, because people will say, God, that doesn't sound like Healing the World One Conversation at a Time.
Right.
And my MO in writing that book is I want to, you know, even though I'm well known around the world, I don't have the leverage or influence that I need to finish the book that I was writing right before Talking to Crazy. Several recent books have been Just Listen, you know, and that became the top book on listening in the world, and we all need to listen better. And then after that, there was a book called Real Influence, which was a very good book, but very much a business-to-business type thing. You know, how do you get stuff done and get people to do things you want them to do without pushing them? And the book I was writing after that was Why Cope When You Can Heal? How to Recover Completely from Trauma. And I've been helping people do that for years. But when I've tried to introduce it, I even wrote a book called Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder for Dummies.
I saw that. That's an interesting title.
Oh, yeah. But what's happened is there's something in the world called barriers to entry.
Yes.
I know top people who will say, oh, speak to our PTSD people, speak to our such and such. And then what happens is you go in there, and of course they're supporting their research. And even though all my work is not research-based, I'm an interventionist. For some reason or other, you put me into an impossible situation with people, you know, and I was a suicide specialist and a hostage negotiation trainer, and there's a good chance I can improve it. Not always, but there's a good chance that I can improve it. And so when people would say, well, what's your research this works? Because, well, people that I've tried it with, they don't kill themselves, and they get better. Yeah, but what's your control group?
Right.
Well, this is a little passive-aggressive. You don't want to say this to the VA. Say, well, my control group is you and all the people that don't get better.
No, you don't want to say that to them.
That doesn't win friends and
no,
influence.
Not at all.
Yeah. So, but getting back to what you're saying, in Talking to Crazy, there are two graphics, and because of my, my increasing affection and respect for you and your listeners, I'm going to send it to you, the PDFs, and then you can make that available to listeners. And
wonderful.
These two graphics, one, and I'll go over them, one is called How Your Personality Develops.
Great.
And I forget the second one. Maybe it's Where Your Personality Starts and How It Develops. But I can describe it, and you can picture the graphic in your mind's eye, and it's exactly what you were saying. When we're born, we're totally vulnerable, we're totally dependent, we're totally needing to trust the people that are taking care of us. And every time we step into the unknown, and the unknown is, you know, crying versus sleeping through the night, you know, not walking, crawling to walking, stay at home versus first day of school. So every time we step into the unknown, we look back. There's a word for that called rapprochement. We look back at the people who are there supposedly helping us. And we look for two things. We look for a patient, accurate warmth. Now, that can come from a mother or father, but mothers tend to be able to generate that warmth. Fathers often, it's a kindness at best. But it can be from either of them. And so when we're afraid or we're in pain, we're looking for that warmth first. We're not looking for solutions when we're still all stirred up. And then what we're looking for from the other parent, sometimes in single-parent homes, you need it from the same person, is we're looking for a really specific, accurate encouragement, which would look like saying, so tell me what happened. Now tell me exactly what happened. And then allowing the child to talk it through. And then saying to the child, so what did you think? What did you feel? What did you do? And then empathizing, oh, that must have been awful. And so what happens is when you do that with a child, they feel less alone, they feel calmed down, and then you can start leading them to not telling them what to do, but, geez, if you had to do that over again, what do you think would have worked out better? Now, early on in life, you tell them what to do, but later on, you get them to think for themselves so they're not overly dependent. So can you picture this in your mind's eye? Yeah.
Well, I can. And, you know, what it sounds like you're saying is that the way to begin healing the world is to literally have one conversation at a time with your children, with your little ones, and take it on from there.
Absolutely. And the second chart, so that's the first chart. It's a picture of kind of people stepping out into the unknown all through life. And by the way, this goes all the way through adulthood. If you're a manager and you're assigning someone to do something and they don't know how to do it, they're going to have the same panicky feeling and they're going to look to you. Well, I don't know how to do this. And are you going to shame them and tell them, well, then you're stupid, or, well, then figure it out, or are you going to, that doesn't mean you coddle them. And so the second graphic, if in your mind's eye, picture this, you're looking back and you're feeling vulnerable, scared, frustrated, and you're looking back at this, we'll call it the caring surround. It's a really awkward term, but it's very descriptive, meaning the total kind of caring around you. Could be parents, could be friends, could be community. And there's four ways that they can respond to you. And it's often a combination of the four ways. It's a single one. And they, here are the four ways. They can coddle you, which means they can spoil you. So they will bail you out and do everything for you. And so you will feel fine as long as they're doing that. But you become hopelessly dependent on them and others to do that for you. When you go out into the world that won't do that for you, it's a rude awakening. And in fact, if all you are is coddled, and coddling means bailing you out of a bad mood, what happens is if your parents change that, like when you become teens or preteens, you have temper tantrums. And what's a temper tantrum? It's a way to manipulate your parents into bailing you out like they did the last time.
And we certainly know there are adults who have temper tantrums as well.
Oh, absolutely. And teenagers, you know, where the can grind down a parent. The parent will say, okay, well, you're grounded for the weekend and you can't use the car. And some teenagers are incredibly gifted at just wearing their parents down. And so the parents are left with saying, okay, well, you can go out and you can take the car, but, you know, you have to be in by 11. And that's because if you've spoiled them, if you really have, to a certain extent, spared the rod, you've spoiled your child. So there's coddling, and then the next thing is there can be a critical parent. And the critical parent is shaming and scolding. And so there you are being afraid because something didn't go well, or you're upset, or you're disappointed. And they lay into you, and they criticize you, and they put you down. And so what happens is if that's the response you get, and you're, again, a young child, when you get to adolescence, your adolescent reaction to the world is, I'll get even.
So then you're a bully.
And then you're a bully because you've been bullied, and you criticize others. And it's a shame because love and anger flows downhill and out into the world.
Yeah.
And so if you're coddled, your adolescent response is, do it for me. If you're criticized and bullied, your adolescent response is, I'll show you. And it's not like a positive thing. I'll show you. I will. I won't live up to my potential. I will embarrass you in front of the community because even though everyone says I'm smart, I'm not going to try. And the reason I'm not going to try is because you didn't try as a parent. You didn't give me what I needed. That's all done unconsciously. And then the third segment is we can be ignored because we have parents who are preoccupied. They could be preoccupied because of depression, because of economic problems, because they're self-centered. And so, again, when we run into obstacles, we're all alone with them. And so often the response to that is we grow up to be timid and fearful and we don't take chances because if you take chances and land on your face, you're all there alone. And so your adolescent response to that is it'll never work. And, again, life can be a combination of these.
Absolutely.
Enter the fourth. And the fourth column is the supportive parent. And to me, a supportive parent is a combination of a loving teacher, mentor, coach. Loving teacher, mentor, coach.
Okay.
And so what happens there is you get, when you hit an obstacle, and you're frustrated, you're angry, you're discouraged, you get that comforting, and you get sort of guidance through it. So when I used to speak to parenting audiences who were mesmerized by what I just told you, I mean, and I said, "What's going on?" They said, "Oh, my life just flashed before my eyes.
Interesting.
Oh, it's too late. I've already messed up my children." I said, "No. These things are fixable." And so I gave them an example, which was, I'd like you to imagine you as a child. So that takes the whole audience back to their whole childhood.
Right.
It is entrancing. And I say, I want you to imagine, let's say you had an accident at school. Let's say you urinated in your clothes and the bully laughed at you and pointed at you and you went and you hid somewhere and they couldn't find you and there is a note from the school saying, bring your parents in because we couldn't find you. So here's what all the different parents look like. You come home, and because, you know, you don't want to re-experience the pain, you know, even though you need to, you know, you don't have the most trusting parents, or you don't trust them. So the coddling parent says, "What happened?" "Well, such and such happened, and, you know, and then they laughed, and you know, I ran away, and now such and is we have to go in." So the coddling parent kind of overdoes it. "Oh, that's so awful. I'm so sorry. We will fix everything, and I'm going to call the parent of that bully, and I'm going to go talk to that school, and how can they allow this to happen? And, you know, we can, and if they don't answer right, we're taking you to another school, and it won't be a problem because we've taken you to 3 schools this year already."
Gotcha.
That's the toddler one. The critical one is, "I told you to go to the bathroom before you go to school in the morning. This is your own fault. And I want you to just sit in your clothes until dinner, until you learn your lesson. Do you understand me?" And so if you're that child, you go up and you're hurt and you're seething and you're all alone.
Right.
The third child with the parent who's not involved, maybe depressed, says, "Oh, it'll be okay. Don't worry about it. Just change. I'm sorry. We got other things in our mind, and it'll be okay. Just get cleaned up, and we'll have dinner." And so, they're not making it worse, but they're certainly not making it better.
Okay.
So imagine this. Here's the ideal. The comforting parent says, "What happened?" In an inviting way. "Oh, nothing. Come on. What happened?" "Well, a little accident." "Tell me about the accident." And then you go on and you describe it. And you're crying because you're less alone. You're able to re-experience it with someone who's loving you. And you just relive it, but you live it with someone who's loving and comforting. And instead of saying, "Oh, it'll be okay," they keep saying, "Well, say more. Then what happened?" "Oh, you must have felt really terrible. What did you feel like when you ran into the girls' room or the boys' room? What did you do next?" "Oh, and then what happened when they said you have to bring in bring us in?" And so what's happening is you're allowing them to get all their feelings out and relive it in the space of your love. But then you add on to it, and this could come from the other parent or you, and that your child might say, "I'm not going back to school tomorrow." Say, "Well, I think you have to." And the reason being is if you don't, you're gonna start becoming afraid of almost anything that doesn't go right. "So tell me a little bit about this bully." "Well, Joey made fun of me, and he got everyone laughing at me, and that's why I ran away and everything." And so imagine this coaching, Pamela. Imagine your parents saying to you, "So tell me a little bit about Joey." "Well, Joey has this edge," and you're saying this to everyone. "Well, let me tell you something about Joey." I'm the parent talking to the child. "There's a good chance that Joey's been bullied. There's a good chance that he's watched something in his home like that, and when he comes to school, he just takes it on other people. So I want us to practice the following. And what you're going to do, and we're going to practice it, is as soon as you go to school tomorrow, you're going to go up to Joey, and do it when he's around all these other kids, and you're going to go up to him, and you're going to put your face about a foot and a half away from his face. So not 6 inches away, but pretty close. And you're going to go up to him, and this is what you're going to say. 'Hey, Joey,' and you'll get his attention. 'I remember yesterday when I had an accident in my clothes, and you said what you said to me, and everyone laughed at me.' And he's going to be totally off balance. And he's going to say, 'Yeah, what? And you look him right in the eye and you say, 'I felt like such a baby. Has that ever happened to you?'" And you just look him right in the eye.
Mark, let me interrupt you. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to hear more about Joey's response to the person he bullied. We'll be right back, folks. This is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Dr. Mark Goldston. Don't go away. Tell us what happens to Joey when he's asked that very pointed, very specific question.
Well, what happens is he starts to fumble. And part of the reason he's fumbling is, they do tell you to stand up to bullies, but a lot of times what you'll teach people is how to fight back, and that's okay, but this is a different way of of fighting a bully. And my whole book, Talking to Crazy, How to Deal with Irrational and Impossible People, is it teaches you how to lean into the difficult person. Because if they provoke you and get you to be either afraid or overly angry, you're off balance. So this is an example of just how to lean into. And so what happened, but imagine you practice that with your child until they get it. Say, I want you to do that, and then I want you to text me how it went, and we'll keep working on it. But the reaction of Joey, not always, is that, first of all, the fact that you're, instead of his bullying you, you approach him, that's a different dynamic, because often he'll be the bully and other people react. So in this case, you're the one being proactive. You're not being a bully, you're being assertive. So that changes the energy, and at the very least, he's kind of off balance, and there he is around his cronies. And you say that, also looking someone straight in the eye. I will tell you, if you look into the eyes deeply of bullies or any irrational person, you will see that there's much more going on underneath it all. And often what's going on underneath the bully, the whiner, or the complainer is fear. And the fear is, sadly, inside these people, is they don't trust anyone in the world. You know, and they're angry about it. And the reason they don't trust anyone is because they didn't get that parenting themselves, and they're angry about it.
So I think that's a really interesting point that deserves to be underscored. These folks who are raging in various ways against someone else are people who feel unsafe themselves and are upset about the lack of safety that they feel. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly it. I would add to what you're saying is they are individuals who in another situation in their life feel out of control, and they are under the control of people who mean them ill. And so what they say to themselves, because they have to endure that, because they can't fight back, you know, with whoever that person or that parent is, and so what these people do. Now, some, many of them turn to drugs and alcohol, and many of them just isolate until 15 years later it all comes rushing down and they do a rampage shooting. But what will happen is they will then go out in the world and take control over someone else. So they will do unto others what was done unto them.
Does so it does. And you know, with this sort of foundation, if you will, for how to think about bullies, a couple of things happen, it seems to me. One is you may start to have some compassion for your bully, and who wants to do that because they really want to be mad at them? Number two, you know, how do you think about that as you're dealing with the adult bully? Who, let's say it's a boss or not necessarily a boss, but a colleague, you kind of don't want to look them in the eye because you're afraid of the retribution as an adult. So here's sort of this, you know, I'm feeling compassion for this person because I now understand in a different way how they got to where they are. But on the other hand, they're still kind of making my life miserable, and I'm not sure that I have any options here.
Well, here's the tool. So if we can finish the anecdote, and what happened in these cases is, you know, Joey just kind of goes around and bullies someone else because you've gotten the better of them. What you've shown is poise under pressure. Poise under pressure is incredibly powerful. And so often those people won't learn the lesson, but they'll go bother someone else because you're not such an easy person to bully. And that's the takeaway for our listeners. But segueing to adults about how do you deal with that bully, and that bully could be a bully, it could be a whiner, it could be a complainer, it could be anyone who triggers in us a huge emotional reaction so that we can't think clearly. And so the tips that I give people in dealing with difficult people, the irrational people, the impossible people in their life, the first thing I say to people is identify those people who are in your life. and you can identify them because they're the ones where as soon as you hear their name, you get a pit in your stomach. Or as soon as you hear their name in a text or voicemail, an email, you go, oh, what now? So you have a physiologic response. So just identify those people and never expect them not to pull that difficult part of their personality out. Now, sometimes they may not, but in other words, don't be blindsided.
Gotcha.
So whenever you're dealing with them, expect that to happen, whatever it is. Expect that comment, expect that whine, expect that complaint. And then the next step is, and since you'll be centered by expecting it, look them in the eye firmly, not confrontationally. If it's on the phone, kind of listen to them in that tone. When they say whatever they say, pause for 2 to 4 seconds. And the reason for that is they often get their way because they provoke people into reacting. And when you pause for 2 to 4 seconds, it means that they didn't get to you. And then you apply what I call the Fudn, F-U-D-N, technique. I think in Talking to Crazy, it was called Fudo, but you can use either one. And what Fudn stands for is frustrated, upset, disappointed, now what? And so you let them finish whatever they're saying, and you'll see they get nervous. They'll say, what? You say, what do you mean? Well, you're not saying anything, and they're nervous because they couldn't provoke you. And what you say to them is, you sound really frustrated. What's that about? And you lead with frustration because most people will talk about frustration. If you say to someone, you seem angry or you seem upset, it fuels a fight.
Right, and denial.
And denial. But most people say, well, I'm frustrated about such and such. And then something that I talk about in both Just Listen and but more so in Talking to Crazy, one of the ways you lean into it is listen for hyperbole, such as, awful or horrendous. Listen for inflection, which is, this has got to change. Or notice adverbs or adjectives. I'm a real student of this. So hyperbole, inflection, adverbs or adjectives reveal some emotion that they're carrying.
Okay.
And so when they say that, this is a horrendous situation. And so the way you lean into it, you say more about the horrendous. So what you do is you lean in to where they're showing that emotion, because what you're really wanting to do is allow them to get stuff off their chest but not have it hit you between the eyes. And you will feel in control of the conversation because you know what you're doing. And so you get them to get through that, their frustration. And what was frustrating about that? Well, this was just an awful such and such. Say more about that. Or another, that's a conversation deepener. Another conversation deepener is you can say, really? And they'll go, oh yeah, this is awful. And then after you get a sense that they've gotten the frustration out, you say, you know, if I was you, or maybe I don't even have to be you, you sound upset too. What's that about? Because really what you want to do is get their upset or anger out, but get it out in a out of harm's way. And then they go into whatever they're upset about. You use the same conversation deepeners. The real tipping point is, first of all, you're going to start feeling more in control of the conversation. But the real tipping point in everything is to say, you know, and you sound disappointed. I don't know if you're disappointed in me, in the company, or whatever, but what are you disappointed about? And there's something about the word disappointment that really takes a lot of the vitriol out of people. And can you picture this in your mind's
eye?
So you've taken them from frustration through upset through disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you do that, they're going to be calmer. At that point, you repeat, let me make sure I understand this, because this is very important. And that's a critical thing to say, because when you tell them that whatever they said was important, they often feel that the world is not treating them as important or not listening to
mm-hmm.
them. So you repeat, this is what you frustrate. frustrated about, this is what upset you, and this is what disappointed you. Is that accurate? And hopefully they'll say yes. Or if they say no, you can say, well, we'll add to it then. And they will. And then you say, I get it. So now what? Or you can use the O. You can say, I get it. So given that all this has happened, what would be the best outcome? That's the O. What would be the best outcome now? And let's see what we can make happen. But can you picture in your mind's eye, Pamela, that it's a way of being able to talk your way through someone who's really being irrational, and not always, but possibly getting them to listen to reason?
Well, I mean, clearly you've sort of gone from, you know, zero to 360 and back to maybe 10 in a relatively short space of time. So it's a very powerful tool. What I wonder about as I am picturing this in my mind's eye is the politicians we have in place nowadays, or the folks who are hurling their racial or sexist or sexual words and anger. How do I take what you have just described as a very calm, methodical, entirely doable, entirely powerful approach in those situations?
Well, I blog everywhere, and I have a blog out, and if I can find it, I'll send it your way. It might be on Huffington Post or Psychology Today. And look, everybody is trying to figure out Trump. I think the blog was How to Trump Trump.
And I'm sure the listeners will want to see that, so do send me the link.
Okay. But the idea is, see, if someone provokes you, like if a Trump provokes you and he provokes everyone, what that does is it so gets you upset that it makes it difficult for you to think rationally, and what you do instead is you react.
So it takes you off your own game. It takes you off center.
It takes you off your own game. And really what it does is, if there's a part of you that wants to smash him or say something back to him, you're uncomfortable with it. You're uncomfortable being inflammatory, whereas he's very at ease with that. And so you're trying to put a lid on what you really want to say, because you're trying to remain in control and civil. And what he's done is he's caused you to bifurcate, meaning you're now spending your energy trying to keep a lid on what you'd like to say back to him, but can't. And so that, and then when he sees that you're bifurcated, he goes in for the kill and makes it worse. So I think in my blog, what I said is, okay, never expect him not to do that. I think I even wrote a blog about how Don Lemon can put the squeeze on Trump.
Okay. And, that would be an interesting matchup.
that would be a good one. But the idea, and tell me whether you think, you know, all bets are off with Trump, because he's a master at deflection. He doesn't need the facts, and the more he lies, the more his polls go up. So he's got a lot of things going for him, and for all the wrong reasons. But my idea would be, if I was a journalist, I would get him, when he says something inflammatory, which is like every other sentence, I would say, say more about building the wall, or say more about what you want to do to China. And so instead of reacting, I would like let him punch me even more. And I'd even keep doing that for a little bit, which would be a little bit discombobulating to him, because most people react by, well, that seems unreasonable and such, and as soon as you say that seems unreasonable, he's got you. So what I would do is I would lean in and let him punch his little heart out, and then I would pause and I'd say, you know, Donald, Mr. Trump, it's clear that you really see this situation very strongly and passionately and different than a lot of other people. Would you agree with that? I guess he would say, yeah. Say, so help everybody who's listening and watching, help us all understand how you came to that point of view from the beginning, how you came to believe that point of view, and how you came to that solution, because you feel so passionate about this and it's so important to you, it obviously matters to you, and I think if you can make a case for how you came to believe what you believe and why you believe it and why you believe this is the only solution, boy, I think there's a lot of people out here who would actually be open to agreeing with you.
Mark.
And he wouldn't be able to do it. He'd say, what? Because he's a reactor.
That's
transactional.
Right. That's a wonderful way, it seems to me, to approach him and people like him. We're going to take another break. Let the listener sort of settle into this approach, because I think it's a wonderful one. And we'll be right back, folks. This is Pamela Brewer having a conversation with Dr. Mark Goldston. Don't go away. Mark, we've talked about how early parenting can impact a child and can impact on into adulthood, although the good news is that one can change if one needs to. And we've talked about bullies, and we've even talked about adult, some people would suggest, bullies in the form of Donald Trump. How do we, so we've got lots of little tiny pieces of understanding. How do we take this understanding and turn it into that one conversation a day with perhaps one person a day where we really focus on healing and not on divisiveness? What do we do? How do we do that?
Can I share another story with you? People remember stories, true?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think this is the best, and I think we've done pretty well so far, but 'cause this is where the mission, healing the world one conversation at a time, and I'll definitely send you the link to this, started. I speak everywhere, and one of my most intimidating conversations or speeches is I was called upon by a friend of mine who does something called Mondays at the Mission. So at the Union Rescue Mission in Los Angeles, possibly one of the largest homeless shelters in the country, he does something where he brings teenagers who are there with their moms. Mainly the dads are on a different floor, or the dads aren't even around in the family. And so Mondays, he brings in teenagers from the age of, I guess, 11 to 17 into a classroom in the mission, and he brings in people to inspire them and motivate them. And he said, oh, Mark, you'll be able to say something. You're great. You're good on your feet. And I said, okay. And then I go there, and it's one of the saddest, most rundown parts of Los Angeles. It is painful to just drive there. And as I'm going in there and I'm walking down the corridor and I'm seeing, you know, it's just the pain of humanity. And, you know, moms and their kids are going in and out of rooms. And I come to this classroom and there are about 20 teenagers. And I'm sitting in the back of the room waiting for Christopher Kai, the wonderful young man who started this program. He's even had Elon Musk speak to these people. So he's had great people. And I'm sitting there thinking, what am I going to say to them? And Chris is being very encouraging, and you can do stuff with your life. And I'm an empath. And as I'm sitting in the back of the room, I'm saying, they're in a lot of fear. They're in a lot of pain. And so I still didn't know what I was going to say. And then what happened is I got up in front of them, and they're all looking at me. and I said, I want to do an exercise with you. I want to turn you into what I call first-class noticers. Because when you notice what you're looking at, you're more present with it. Noticing is different than looking, watching, and seeing. So if I notice the printer right next to me, which is 6 years old, I notice it has packing tape on it. So that means I must have been in a hurry to just use it. But you know, I didn't notice that for 6 years. So what I did is I went through the front row, and I have really very amazing eye contact with people, but it comes from a good place because I used to work with highly depressed and suicidal people who didn't speak, and I'd look under their eyes with a look that said, wherever you are, you're going to walk out, and I'm not going to let go of you, and you're not falling through any cracks. And I would say that with my eyes, and I think it was helpful. In another call, we'll talk about who did it for me and where did I learn to pay this whole thing forward,
okay,
the whole backstory to this. And so what happened is I then had them notice something in the room they'd never noticed. I said, close your eyes. 10 seconds later, open them, and they said, oh, I noticed that there's a stain on the wall. Oh, I noticed the clock isn't working. Oh, I noticed there's a stack of DVDs. And then I said, here's where healing the world one conversation at a time started. I said, I want you to partner with each other, look into each other's eyes, using that noticing thing. And I want you, and you're going to take turns, I want you to say to the other person, what's the worst thing in your life? And they did that, and within 30 seconds, half the room's crying. And what's happening is the person is answering it, and they're looking into the eyes of someone who cares about them. What they say is, being here. And then and the volunteers were saying, what's going on? I said, it's okay. You know, I manage that kind of stuff because this is my space. And then we reversed it, and the same thing happened. And maybe you can even feel it, Pamela. It flipped the whole room.
I can imagine. Yeah.
It became intimate. And I said to them, because I wasn't finished yet, I said, here's your homework. I want you to go to your mom's, and you could do it tonight, you could do it this week. And at some point, I want you to look them in the eye, and say to them the same question, Mom, what's the worst thing for you right now? And I said, a quarter to a third of your moms are going to start crying, and you didn't make them cry. You're giving them relief because they feel scared, they feel ashamed, they feel awful. And when they cry, keep looking them in the eye, and what you're going to say to them, you're going to put your arm around their shoulder, and you're going to keep looking at them. And they may even look away, and you can say, Mom, look at me. And you say to them, Mom, we're going to be okay, and I love you. And what will happen is that will be amongst the top three conversations either you or your mom have in your life. So it just flipped everything.
Can you
picture that?
I can feel that, absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's what drives me. I think it's possible to do something like this.
For the person, you know, I'm thinking about the mass shooters, if you will. I'm thinking about the kids who go into the schools or the adults who just seem to whip out a gun and kill as many people as they can. It seems as though, for whatever reason, they had many moments in their life when nobody spent that time with them that you just described. Is that a reasonable assumption?
I think that's a reasonable assumption, but a lot of times something was so beyond words that even if people tried to get through, they'd say, leave me alone. And so a lot of times when teenagers need you most, they push you away. And this is a very important segue. And anyone who's listening that can help me, we can change the world together. I am co-authoring a book with a man in his 40s, and it's called Inside the Mind of a School Shooter. 25 years ago, he had 1,000 rounds of ammunition, and he had guns placed in his high school, and he was all set to shoot a bunch of people, do a rampage killing. And then he went to church, And he, you know, someone dragged him to church, and he had a revelation. I mean, he didn't expect it, and it changed his life. He got the guns out safely, and no one ever knew that he did this. His parents had sent him to a psychologist, but he never told the psychologist. I'm thinking of, you know, killing everyone in my school. Never told his parents. And he was teased and bullied, and this book is all about his being teased and bullied, but reaching this point where he didn't do it. And we've checked with the DA, and, you know, there was a crime, putting guns in a school, but it's past the statute of limitations. And what started out with my giving him a blurb for the book, I think he's an angel sent to the world to do something. And so we're co-authoring this book in which he will tell his story, but I will weigh in each chapter about if you're a parent and you're worried about this happening in your community, if you're a teenager and you have this level of rage, this is what Dr. Goulston says. And so I'll weigh in about this is what you could say, this is what that might be going on. And so it's really quite an amazing book. And then so we see the book coming out, hopefully, and doing a Kickstarter or Indiegogo thing in which the main author and I will just reach out and say, if you donate X, you'll get a copy of the book, but you will also fund our going to any community in the country and speaking to teachers, parents, and teens about this, because people will love my co-author. I mean, it's... when I told him that if this book goes nowhere, he's unemployable and he's going to have to explain to his wife and child why they're on welfare, and that's in my foreword to the book before I got so involved, he said to me, he said, Dr. Goulston, you don't understand. I have to write this book, because if it stops one shooting and saves one life that I will never know about, it'll all be worth it. And I don't have a choice. And he just won me over.
Interesting. Amazing.
So anyone who's listening, anyone who says, hey, we can help with that, you know, we're still in the planning stages, but would like to get this thing going.
Well, it certainly sounds like a powerful write and a powerful read. So, of course, when that's out, we'll have to have you back again to talk about that one.
Oh, absolutely.
In the moments that we have left, there are so many ways in which people harm each other with words. How would you like for us to think about approaching that person who we decide we don't like the way they look, or they have a disability, or they are a different color, or a different gender, different... How should we think about approaching that person who we really don't like, really don't want to like? And before you even answer that, why should we? Why should people want to change to create this world that you're talking about?
Well, because there is a good chance that if you're someone who looks at those people with disdain and doesn't want to touch them with a 10-foot pole, there's a good chance that you yourself have had an experience in which something about you caused other people to not want to touch you with a 10-foot pole. So what I would say to you is, tell me about a time when something beyond your control caused the world to really treat you poorly, laugh at you, ridicule you, and you had no defense against it, because you learned some of this from something. Or tell me about watching a parent belittle another parent, and you watched it powerlessly. And so what I would do is I would get the person who doesn't want to have compassion to talk about an incident from their own life where they needed compassion and didn't receive it, or they sat by and watched one parent just kick the heck out of the other one, and they just sit back and watched it helplessly. And so what I try and do is get people back to their own feeling of what it's like to have the world against you and have nothing you can do about it. And then I would say to them is, knowing how badly that feels, would you want to perpetuate that, perpetrate that on someone else? I mean, knowing how bad that feels, have it done to you, you'd want to do that to another person? So I try to get them, when you can't get someone to understand another person's feelings, get them to feel them.
Gotcha. What a powerful way, really, for everyone who's listening to begin to think about approaching healing the world through one conversation at a time. And it sounds like it begins with perhaps healing oneself one conversation at a time.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in my book, Talking to Crazy, something that may or may not surprise you is when I'm having a rough time or I'm about to beat up on myself because I made a mistake, at my core, and I've always felt myself weak because of this, at my core, I'm not an I. At my core, I'm a we. And on a good day, I'm a lonesome warrior. And on a bad day, I'm not the warrior. And so when I'm having a bad day, I've been blessed to have six mentors who've all passed away. And I just think of any of them. And I think of them smiling at me. And I think of them loving me unconditionally. And I lean into feeling blessed that I had such people believe in me when I didn't. And what happens is I go from that, you know, half-filled, half-empty glass because of the disappointment, to suddenly I just let in the memory of these six mentors. And I can even feel them now. I can feel it in my cheekbones, and I see they're all smiling at me. And it's amazing. It's like I'm automatically filled up. I mean, it's like I go from feeling half-filled to my cup runneth over. And how blessed was I to have these people in my life.
Dr. Goldston, we are certain to have you back again. As we wrap up the conversation today, I know you have several websites. Can you just share one with us that the listeners can go to for more information?
Go to GouldstonGroup.com.
Okay.
GouldstonGroup.com. One quick, quippy comment. My book's Just Listen, which became the top book on listening in the world, is on special at Kindle, so you can go there. Talking to Crazy is an interesting exercise in mismarketing, because when I came up with a title, people have told me, I love that title, Talking to Crazy. I deal with that every day. I need that book. I want that book. But then what's happened is people bought much more on Kindle than the hardcover. And I said, why is this happening? What someone said is, you know, you can't buy a book called Talking to Crazy and leave it anywhere for people to see, because they'll think you're talking about them. So if you're a manager, you can't have a book that says Talking to Crazy and leave it on your desk, because when your subordinates come in, they'll think you're talking to them. So it's like having pornography.
So noted.
So I'm going to push my publisher and say, I want to print up a bunch of extra copies of the cover for Just Listen, and when you send people Talking to Crazy, send them the cover from Just Listen so they can put a different cover on.
There you go. Thank you so much. We will absolutely have you back again.
I look forward to that.
All righty, you take care. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. Do remember that you can listen to this and any program on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Folks, you remember always, If it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.